Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we are covering one of my all-time favorite films, Apollo 13. To join me in the cockpit of this three-man mission is Jason Wingrove. How are you, sir?
Very good.
And Very good. Also join us in this virtual Volkswagen with a rocket attached is Matt Woolman. How are you, Matt?
Great. Great to be here.
So, Matt, let's start with you. Do you share my enthusiasm for this incredibly awesome, great, fabulous, brilliant film?
You know, I will say that it is the best Hollywood blockbuster film telling the story of Apollo 13.
Okay.
I do really like it. I do think it's a good movie. My only sort of critique that I would want to just toss in there is it's a personal bias, and I just happen to be... One of my top five films of all time, I think, is probably Philip Kaufman's 1983 version of The Right Stuff.
Yep.
And, I know that, you know, that's an earlier era narrative, but it sort of is capturing that same that same sort of decade, you know, that decade of man going into space.
But it captured the slightly more because let's face it, the Apollo guys were the clean-cut version of the
Mercury,
you know, the right
guys.
Stuff guys.
Yeah. Cowboys.
Yeah.
And the Mercury guys were hard-drinking test pilots who faced buying the farm every day. The Apollo guys, by comparison, were poster boys of American, you know, sort of culture.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I mean, they had to... Mm. But that's fine because I don't think one takes away from the other. I think they're both great films. But I think this is a particularly great film. But Jason,
Absolutely. I love this film more than life itself.
I've got to say, also, I find Ron Howard to be insanely good as a director. Really, really interesting. And one of the aspects about him that we're going to touch on as our concurrent topic, because as you know, listeners, we like to have two topics: the main film itself, and there's some aspect about it that that we think is interesting. We're going to get into a lot of technical stuff, but I want to get into some non-technical stuff, guys, about his as Ron Howard's role as a collaborator, because he did collaborate very heavily with key members of this production, as he does on every film. And obviously, what we have here is someone. Like Matt, who's incredibly experienced working at major facilities as a VFX artist and supervisor. But we've also got a director in Jason who's obviously keen to somehow get his vision up on the screen. So I think that'll be an interesting topic. We'll hit up that later in the show. But let's start with some stats. And Matt, are you aware as to how many VFX shots Digital Domain actually produced for this?
You know, I didn't get the exact shot count. I was sort of, counting in my head, and it was fairly low by today's standards, although I'm sure, you know, high
by... a couple of hundred was the tally that that I had.
Which is amazing, really.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously there's a lot of stuff that that is on Earth, so, you know, that would not require a lot of VFX work. And then, quite frankly, when they're inside the lunar module or the confined space, there was... Some VFX work naturally because of the weightlessness, though, as we will get into, they used famously the actual NASA Vomit Comet. And they could do that because this is the first film that I'm aware of that actually had NASA support in being made, and that gave them an amazing amount of access, right down to the fact, I don't know if you guys picked up on this piece of trivia, but when they were doing the mover that moves the rocket from where it's set up to the launch pad, they used a modern-day... A shuttle crawler, and they composited over the top of it a miniature.
Oh, wow.
Ron Howard got to drive that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of... I got to do lots of cool stuff making this film. I'm incredibly jealous just about the production, not of guys necessarily that went into space, but just the guys that the physical making of this film. It's about the closest you would actually get to becoming an astronaut, donning the right gear, getting into the command module and... going into the Vomit Comet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like, I don't know where we want to start, but I guess we've already touched on it, so let's keep going there. The idea of the production itself, the fact that they wanted to get weightlessness, of course, but they approached it by actually putting a set inside a NASA simulator, which simulates weightlessness by basically shooting up in the air on a parabolic path and then sort of falling very, very fast for a very long period of time, but that only still gives you about 2 minutes of weightlessness, but it does give you...
22 seconds.
22 seconds, I thought it was 2 minutes, oh my God.
Well, you do a few dives at a time, but every little burst is 22 seconds, and then after that you go to like 2 Gs.
2 Gs on the other end, yeah.
So, but you get a few dives in each sort of run, and then you
Right, maybe back. Maybe I read that you get 2 minutes per flight, but either way, that just 22 second, that's one take. That gives you something that I think really does resonate as a huge amount of authenticity on the weightlessness in the. And I'm thinking in particular, the shot that always stood out in my head is when the cassette player is flipped. And you just. Now, there are other shots where it's obvious the cassette player, if you know anything about it, is on a rod and someone's puppeteering it. But that one shot where he's spinning it in two different degrees of axis, you know. Would now it would only be done, I guess, with a full CG replacement, but it's
and there's later on. I think later on when the command module starts to get all cold and it's sort of everything's slowing down and icing up. There's just a great shot of just it just sort of bumping around the capsule by itself and just with great sound design. It's just you as you say, you just couldn't that on a string or a rope just would not work. It just had such amazing reality.
This is a bit like the establishing shot, isn't it? Because once we've had a couple of real weightless shots, I can buy the rest of the guys sitting on kind of big rubber balls and just swaying around because I've had the effectively, to use that analogy, establishing shot of the real weightlessness, and it's enough to make my brain kind of connect the dots.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, you know, being able to make those connections and the use of the vomit comet, as it were, I mean, I remember all of the ancillary material, the press-related material that came out around the time the film came out. I mean, it was a big story, and there were, you know, stories on, you know, all of the news shows that deal with sort of Hollywood-related items, and they were talking about how they actually went and did this, and they had interviews with the actors and with, you know, Ron Howard and the other filmmakers talking about who got sick the most and whatnot. And I think once they established that look and they got it such that, you know, they were able to replicate a lot of the actual NASA footage, one of the things I was going to mention was is the documentary for All Mankind, the Academy Award-winning documentary, that there are several shots that they lift straight out of that documentary and replicate almost one-to-one with the stuff they do on the set. But once they got those first zero-G shots, I mean, yeah, you could pretty much buy anything. You know, you felt really like you were in that space. You were in the capsule with them, you know, on their journey, and the tension, you know. I was going to mention, too, just from a purely filmmaking point of view, if I might, just something about the script in general. I don't know if you guys, you know, were thinking about this much as you were watching it, but I really paid close attention to the fact that it was one of the most efficient scripts that I've seen. They were able to use all kinds of, you know, kind of goofy devices to convey huge amounts of technical information that you needed to have in order to really feel as a member of the audience that these guys were really genuinely in peril. And they would do stuff where, you know, there's the scene where the Jim Lovell, Tom Hanks character is talking to his kid on the bed about
That's a brilliant piece of exposition, isn't it? What a great way to get exposition out for the audience without...
But also have emotion in it as well.
Yeah, and the wife listening at the door for the... Was it the door? That comes later was brilliant filmmaking.
And there's so much of that. They do so much of that in this movie. It's just incredible watching it. How tight.
Another good one was when they go into the room and he sort of draws. He tries to draw on the overhead projector. It fails.
Yeah.
And then he pulls up the blackboard and says, "Well, you know, draws this picture, which is the simplistic picture the audience needs to understand. We are here. We need to get to here." Mm-hmm. But you actually get a character to draw that simplistically for the audience as he's simplistically drawing it for the team. These are really difficult problems because exposition can be such a laboring sort of...
I guess they could also rely on, you know, a lot of the TV reports, the old sort of Cronkite kind of archival news reports as well, because that's explaining it, you know, quite simply for...
And there was a lot of that integration. They did integrate a lot of that genuine historical, you know, the Walter Cronkite stuff and whatnot into the actual film pretty seamlessly too.
So for anyone that doesn't know or didn't pick up on Matt's earlier comment, they did use absolutely zero NASA space footage. So they used archival footage of the television reports. That's absolutely true and integrated it very well. And Walter Cronkite, I think, is completely, even for an Australian who never had him on our sets, linked to that Apollo period. But they didn't use anything from NASA, mainly because the footage tended to be obviously of different quality levels, from magnificent to not so great.
But they did go and match particular shots. Oh, totally. Though. I mean, they made a really like stuff in particular when they're on the gantry walking towards the rocket for the first time, about to leave. There's literally like shot per shot, it's identical. The camera position, the camera movement, the movement of the actors through the frame to actual NASA footage. I mean, it's just,
well, the one I was going to refer was that separation of the stages of the rocket when they're actually first going up. That mm-hmm. that footage is so iconic that mm-hmm. I, when I was watching in the cinema, thought it was NASA footage.
Well, so did I think that was that classic fantastic story after this first screening of the film, that which I think it was certainly some NASA guys or ex-astronauts came up to Ron Howard and said, "It's fantastic. This is that launch sequence. Where did you find, you know, where did you find that fantastic archival footage?" I said, "Oh, well, no, we kind of built it from scratch." Oh, okay, cool.
I went to a talk that was with the VES, where, I don't know if you went to this, Matt, where Buzz Aldrin was there. And so they were talking about Apollo 13. Mm-hmm. And then Buzz came. It was such a, like, one of the great VES moments. They were like discussing the shots, and I should, I don't know how we've gone this far into the podcast without mentioning Rob Legato, because this was by far, you know, something that that Rob was instrumental in doing. But I'll come back to Rob. But anyway, so he's discussing the takeoff and how they were doing things and stuff. And then after they'd been discussing the effects for a while, as you normally get at one of these presentations with before and afters, and we're all, of course, sitting there really interested, he turns and he says, "And so to see whether or not we got it right or not, here is, in fact, somebody that was in one of the Apollo launches, Buzz Aldrin." And Buzz walks out and then discusses all the shots from his point of view of whether or not they're accurate. And, I mean, it was humbling even for me as an Australian to be in the presence of one of the original Apollo 11 crew. But, there has an authenticity to it in this film that I think tends to almost rewrite history. Because you kind of believe the launch is exactly how they did it, because it looks so darn believable. Yeah, I think it was described by Buzz as being a darn sight more shaky than but apart from that, you know, like it really has every documentarian kind of feel about the camera angles. And I think that was important, because they didn't give us the... I mean, there was a few hero god shots flying around that were clearly cinematic and not...
But somehow the imagery within those frames, you just completely buy it. They were still, I don't remember, at least watching it at the time, any shot, I don't remember any of them really standing out as being, you know, feeling unrealistic. Even, as you say, the god shots or impossible angles, even those standing out, they all still had real imagery inside them.
Yeah, and I was going to say too, you know, I mean, if you're a sort of a space nerd, and I would say I'm definitely a science and space nerd when it comes to this. Yeah, right. I mean, it's like when it comes to this stuff, it's like I love seeing it, watching anything and everything I can, especially about that era, you know, where they were really sort of pushing, you know, pushing the envelope, as they say. That Saturn V, especially for Apollo 11, that Saturn V launch was so... The photography and the slow motion photography that they did of that launch itself has become so iconic, and it's so familiar. It's something that, you know, if you're a nerd like me, you would have watched this numerous times. And for them to be able to go out and rep, and like you said, Mike, not to use any of the actual NASA mission footage, and to replicate all this both through practical means and digital means, in, you know, direct sunlight and whatnot for the launch itself. I mean, it was quite a testament to the success of the effects team that they were able to replicate those shots in such a fashion that, you know, they're almost indiscernible to the actual footage.
Well, let's set the stage before we go further into the individual shots, because as we like to do with these retro apps, we should place it in its both historical and technical context. So this is Digital Domain at the beginning of the golden period. So it was, what, 2 years into DD's life. DD, of course, being set up in part by Jim Cameron and other great filmmakers, and had, what, two films out before this? I think there was Interview with a Vampire, and I think one other.
And True Lies was 94.
Yeah, so, and so then Apollo 13, I personally think, should have won the Oscar the year it came out, but that was 95, yeah. And it was up against Babe. Now, yeah, I know. I know, we'd had talking animals since Mr. Ed, but hey, Take nothing away from Rhythm and Hues, but yeah, Apollo 13 should have won. Anyway, the thing is, we're 95, and people like Jim Cameron are still intimately involved in DD. He obviously later wasn't. So much so that, in fact, it was his presence at a meeting with Ron Howard and his offer to help out if required, which wasn't required, that pushed DD over the line into being the company that was accepted to make this, because there were a few companies that were up for the roster. And I think also the name Digital Domain at that time just grabbed by the balls the kind of essence of what DD was about. It was this sense that they were the ones that were moving forward into the digital era using all the digital tools. And Rob Legato, more than I guess anybody else, came from that background, because Rob's background prior to that was a lot of Star Trek Next Generation. Okay. Mm. And Star Trek Next Generation had pioneered the use of what we might call video effects, the early Harry and then Flame, mm-hmm. Henry, that kind of stuff. And Digital Domain, you know, fully embraced that, because Digital Domain was the company, more than ILM at that stage, that was leading the charge into doing effects using those television-type effects as opposed to doing the traditional film optics. So it's at this and, of course, True Lies was awesome. So this was like an absolute golden era. And, of course, Rob Legato would then go on to do Titanic, quite a good film. Went quite well.
No. Effects at the time.
And of course, later in his career, after having done a whole bunch of other great stuff, almost too much to mention, like Harry Potter and a bunch of other stuff, Castaway, would do once again for Cameron Avatar, but he'd also, you know, has done a bunch of other films with Scorsese and others. So he's a very significant visual effects supervisor, and we're going to come back to him later in the show, because I really think that Rob Legato, on the shots that we're going to be talking about, had a very strong creative role in collaborating with Ron Howard. And as I said at the opening of the show, we're going to discuss that. So let's go into the individual shots, unless you guys want to add to the technology of the era.
I did say one thing. Oh, sorry, Jason, you go ahead.
No, I was just researching 1995, just looking at, just not that they use Macs for all of this, but looking at the fastest Mac of 1995 is like 190 megahertz.
Yeah.
Okay. Like Power Mac 9500 190.
Okay. And did it have a hard drive? Sorry.
No, I was just going to say one thing that I thought of when we were talking about doing this show. I thought, oh, that's a great one to do, because, you know, I sort of went back and looked kind of at the sort of all the seminal movies that were coming out at this time that were sort of really getting into this transition from the practical to the digital arena. And, you know, you have, starting within 89, you have The Abyss, and then Terminator 2 in 1991, Jurassic Park in 1993, Forrest Gump and True Lies in 94, Casper, which I think is an overlooked film in terms of its character animation, in 95, Jumanji, also in 95, and Apollo 13, and then moving on into Twister and Dragonheart in 96, and Titanic in 97. And I think if you go back and look at all of these movies, including Apollo 13, they're all pretty interesting to look at on an individual basis, because they're all developing and pushing the state of the art in terms of the technology for to serve the story in each instance, but also pushing a particular technique into the digital arena that had once been the purview of practical effects. And I think it's really fascinating to see this sort of historical progression, and see where, in the case of Jurassic Park, you get your first sort of photorealistic computer graphics, Forrest Gump, the historical manipulation, in Casper, as I mentioned, you get the first real fully blown out character animation. And then in Apollo 13, I think you're starting to see the first implementation of some serious particle simulations and particle fluid and thermal dynamic simulated effects in conjunction with hard surface models in broad daylight. And I think it's interesting to look at the film in context like that as well, and to sort of, I think, you know, if you go back and look at this film now, it holds up really well. But I think if you look at it and you aren't cognizant of the history and the technology and just the actual era in which this film was made, I think for, you know, maybe for some of our younger listeners, they might look at this and be like, oh, it's not that great, you know. But at the time, I think it's the kind of thing, it was and still, I think it still holds up great, but it really was the state of the art, and they were really pushing what was possible in this film, and all the films in this era, I think, as well.
Yeah. I mean, I constantly marvel at what they achieved with what they had to hand, you know. Yeah. Again, going back to the computers they had to work with. I mean, just your iPhone has five times the processor speed of the Mac I mentioned.
Yeah.
And obviously the Silicon Graphics stuff was beyond that. But it's not that long ago, yet when you look back at stuff like that, it's ancient history in terms of the gear the guys had to work with. And as you say, they're developing software and tools as they go. Nowadays, there's so many of this stuff, it's just plug-in. You can just go on the net and download something to do particle stuff. And back then, they had to literally build this stuff, and this was like absolutely cutting edge to be able to.
Yeah, I mean, much like the
much
like the astronauts in the True Story, right? I mean, not to say that these effects artists are risking their lives, but I mean, you know, they're pushing the envelope in terms of the technology and trying to really develop the technology and the techniques and the methodologies, the algorithms, whatever you want to say about it, in order to actually execute these effects to this level. And you know, it's all predicated on the needs of the specific project, but you know, it was a pretty exciting time in visual effects. It was really this era, the late 80s into the mid 1990s, where things were really turning fast. And you know, I often tell my students, and I think that's kind of like you were saying about digital domain was a relatively new shop at this time, but I often tell my students at school, I tell them that, you know, this was an interesting period because I started at ILM in 1992 and there were 250 employees. When I left in 1999, there were over 1,500 employees. So, you know, this was a period of time where things were really changing and changing really rapidly. And this project really encapsulates a lot of that in a really fitting way, I think.
Yeah, what was interesting for me personally is I went on set of Apollo 13 at Digital Domain. Price Petrel was the on Apollo 13, he was the digital compositing supervisor. So he was the head of digital compositing, and Price is a friend and a really, I think, incredibly brilliant compositing digital supervisor. And so there's a couple of points I want to pick up on that, because the first one is over the hard surface modeling stuff. As much as I totally agree with you on that, and I would like to discuss it more, we shouldn't also pass the fact that at this stage, Digital Domain had an incredible model shop. They were building their own cameras, and there were a lot of models. In fact, when I went on set, it wasn't on set for the actors. It was on set for all the miniatures and the photography of those miniatures being, yeah, you know, the various, either the space, you know, the limb or the, you know, the actual rocket assemblies and that kind of stuff. So there were big stages at Digital Domain, specifically for shooting miniatures, motion control, and up to like 33 passes would be done on models. So we'll come back to that in a sec. The other thing on the computer front is, I know that you were referring to, you know, what was the state of the art for a Mac, say, for, say, you or I in the street, but
yeah.
I remember standing in the computer room with Price, and I asked him how many flames he had, how many Onyxes. Now, this is the day that an Onyx computer basically cost you $1 million. And so we're standing, leaning on a $1 million computer in shrink wrap with our coffees, chatting. And Price was like, I think we have, I don't know how many we got, 12, 13, 14, I don't know. And I was just awestruck that you could have that many $1 million computers and you wouldn't even know how many you had because you just had them lying around. And of those, every one but one was in film. Only one was in the commercials division. And I should note that the commercials division had a really nice, pretty room at that stage for directors to come and swan around in, though all of the compositors that were working at Digital Domain seemed to me to be in the equivalent of a digital troll environment where it was like the dark depths. But not only was it...
That said, just quickly, Wikipedia, the Onyx, the later ones, even the later faster ones running about 250 megahertz. Again, an iPhone 4 runs at 1
gig. Okay, but what made an Onyx computer so powerful and why it worked so well with Flame, which was obviously used in the compositing for a huge amount of this, is that it had this vast graphics pipeline. So what you think of as a computer today is primarily a CPU-based thing, and then we think of having a graphics card with GPU. A lot of that came from this era, but then it was a giant pipeline of about 4 or 5 massive cards the size of a 22-inch monitor. And what would happen is that the controlling computer, which wasn't particularly fast, was very good at pumping stuff into this circular pipeline that would loop around. Yeah, I know what an Onyx looks like. I owned one. And they he's just trying to show me a picture off Wikipedia.
No, of this particular graphics card that you
I know exactly what it looked like. So anyway, the point is that you had this pipeline of graphics processors, which today we would shrink down. We just simply give the label of GPU and buy from NVIDIA. But back then it was a refrigerator of graphics cards. And so the power and the performance that you got out of this was this idea of two things. That a ton of disks so they could get real-time playback on a flame. And secondly, it had a ton of compute power in the graphics pipeline so you could stacks up through the pipeline and iteratively loop it through the pipeline to process. And so you weren't CPU-based. And that technology is what made Flame the huge success it was and why they bought them, and also why we do that today.
And so most of the composites that were done at DD at this time for the show, were they all mostly done in Flame?
Yeah, absolutely, because if you think about it, Shake came out of LA, but it came out as the sort of workstation-y option off against kind of the big grunt. This was the era of big iron. Like you had $1 million box, one operator, even though these things had been designed to be a computer for use with, 20, 30, 50 people.
Mm.
You gave one operator a rocket, you strapped them to it, and you basically fed them coffee and asked them never to leave the room, and they just worked like gods. And they were. They were like, it was...
Because there were comps being run, I know, at this time elsewhere, where they were running comps on Indigo 2s or on... Was the O2 released at this time, too? But they were using almost entirely script-based compositing tools.
Totally. And there was other... Alias had a compositor. There was a bunch of other
Parallax
tools out there.
Parallax had a product, didn't they, at the time?
But in this film, you've got a lot of live action, in many cases green screen, but a lot of... compositing of live action stuff. It wasn't the sort of CG pipeline that Shake was handling so well.
Yeah.
It was, I have footage, I have to solve this problem. There's a postage stamp of green screen in there somewhere that I'm going to use. So the reason I'm bringing that up is because even though the computers were, whatever, it was the digital domain had both. It had tons of hardcore, mega expensive computers. And it had a bunch of hardcore, we can make our own cameras, milling machine models teams. Mm. And so you just had this just dream team that was hitting these projects. And now I know over the time the number of sound stages for shooting motion control at DD has dwindled.
But you don't quite need to fit Titanics in there anymore.
But to give you an idea of some of the great stuff that that Price in particular did, which I... because I take nothing away from Rob, but, Price was like on the front line. I remember looking at some of the shots. When they've got some shots pulling away from the craft in space, there's one in the dream sequence, there's another one when they're seeing the stuff that's coming off the side of the ship that's from the accident and stuff. So Price really wanted to bloom the highlights on the... because in space you get that. And compositing back then had a lot of trouble with sort of blooming the highlights properly and kind of blowing things out. It tended to composite along the lines of the mat rather than the sort of natural optical qualities of it.
Yeah, you wouldn't keep those super whites blooming over the top of a mat line somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. So Price just hooked up a bloody great camera to one of their high-resolution monitors, and they started refilming their work off the screen so they could optically overexpose and adjust the exposure.
To get the bloom,
to get it looking more filmic. I mean, there was just nothing these guys wouldn't do to try and get that level of realism.
Can I bring one thing up? I'm sort of curious I want to hear your guys' opinion. There's actually two shots in particular that relate directly to what you just said with regards to the lens flares. And the first being, there's one shot early on before the rocket takes off. And it's towards the tail end of a kind of a large sequence of shots. And it's, I don't know if you would remember this one, but it almost looks like it has, I made a note of it, it has this almost kind of HDR-y kind of quality to it. And it's got a real big lens flare where you see just the top edge of the gantry and the top part of the command module.
Yes.
It's, and it's a really big flare.
Really, really big flare.
Right. And it's one shot that, like, I made a note of it. Just, Is it one bad flare? Because I will say that, you know, from my personal taste, that was one where I thought that was a bit dodgy, that shot, and I wasn't sure.
Okay, I'm with you on that. But contrast that with some of the stuff in space where you get that flicker in the flare, where that it isn't the kind of, like, today often people do lens flares and they are very static and very kind of consistent. And yet in my experience, when you're shooting with real cameras, jump in here if I'm wrong, Jace, you get an almost vibration.
You know, a bit of chopping from the shutter inside the whole mirror box thing, and then you get the, there's a lot of sort of interaction there from all the physics. This is a physical moving machine.
And of course, space is glary. I mean, that's the nature of what makes it, you know, so interesting photographically is that
when you get like the halation and the chromatic aberration and all that kind of stuff in there too.
There's no atmosphere, you know, so there's a lot of it's a very, very different place optically.
And so people like Price and the rest of the team, I think, did an enormously good job in nailing that glare, just for to put one single word on it. It just felt glary.
And I'm sure they're pulling a lot of that reference from NASA photographs. They use some NASA photographs in there, here and there, blowing them up and using them as plates and then sort of animating them. But mostly, I imagine, they just used them as reference, got a lot of that blooming thoughts from archival shots.
But to back you up on, like, you know, it wasn't all like they had everything, even though it was, as I call it, the dream team. There was shots pulling away from the craft where the miniature was enormous. I was standing right in front of it, and it was pretty bloody big. And back then, we had real issues with resolution. And so they were doing that by literally doing four passes for each corner of the screen, if you split the screen into four quadrants. So they did four motion control pullbacks for each four quadrants of the screen, because they couldn't get the high resolution, because we didn't have, you know, the 4K, the super high res, you know, IMAX 16K crap with, you know, can happen.
So they did four, they would do four like at 2K then? Or is that what they
did? Yeah, four quads, but they would maybe do 20 passes in each of the four. Oh, so you'd end up with like having to put together four patches to produce one giant image. And you'd have to do that with 20 passes. Yeah. And here's the other thing which I thought just blew my mind at the time, and I remember, to this day, I remember looking at this and just going, oh, I need to learn more technically. no, seriously, as I looked over and they had the model set up and there was no green screen there. There was this kind of what I called red screen. And I just looked and it was like somebody hit me in the head with the you're stupid stick, because I was like, I just assumed it was going to be green or blue screen. The idea that you'd light with narrow frequency red light, and the amount of thought they'd put into this, I don't know if you guys read any about this or whatever, but I remember seeing it. The miniatures weren't lit, which you can do, of course, with miniatures. You can't do with people, because red light on skin would be horrendous. But you can do multiple passes of a miniature ship, and so they would get very, very narrow frequency spectral spikes out of basically lighting these with a kind of a red. And they were doing it because they believed back then that they were going to get the sharpest image out of the red
for the matte line
channel of the film, because the blue is where you hide a lot of the film grain noise, because our eye is not susceptible to blue. So if you look at the three layers, and they imagined that, they had thought that blue being crap, that red would be the next best option. As it turned out, actually green technically is slightly sharper, but that actually helped them, because when they were integrating the red layers, the very subtle kind of softening of the edges that we got from the red channel actually helped, without the grain, helped make the comps go together. But this was like a level of kind of technical understanding of film, of optical responses, of frequency responses, of digital compositing. And I remember just seeing, like, I remember feeling like I knew shit. I knew nothing. Like, it was like a big moment for me of going, I need to get off my ass and kind of learn this stuff, because this wasn't, you know, it looked good. This was...
What was the sort of scanning technology back then? I mean, to get, obviously, we're getting into digital domain. So what...
I'm going to say this was Oxbury scanners, Matt, with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's... I mean, I know... my experience is colored by my own work experience, but I know at ILM, Lincoln Hu and Josh Pines and stuff, they built a couple different scanners and film recorders and stuff, and that the equipment that was built at the time, I believe, was... analogous to if they didn't actually have an Oxbury, but it was analogous in some form. So right, that so would
it was,
make
it was
sense.
The Oxbury CT scan. Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Okay. This is very sort of, you know, first, second gen stuff.
This is Oxbury 35mm film scan. This is what before we got the laser scanners right. and the laser printers. And we're not talking optical printing here. We're just talking like the actual and, scanning of the film and output. Right, at the end.
And going to 2K, I guess, would have been the maximum.
Oh, yeah, no, totally. It was 2K.
Yeah, I think it was like, it was, wasn't it right around this time that everything went from, we started doing all of our conversions, right? And then we were working in 10-bit log, or is that?
Because the first workstation compositor that really stopped Flame from moving into from a dominant position was Cineon. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we think of Cineon now as Cineon Files. We're talking about now the Cineon film compositor.
Right.
And that's where the Kodak guys came up with the 10-bit format that is the Cineon file that became the kernel of a DPX or the inside of the container that is DPX.
But was that around in 1995? I don't actually even remember, to be honest.
I'm gonna be able to check that for you while we talk.
It's like one of those real geeky things, but it's interesting to note, I guess, when you're thinking about
it. If you listen to this podcast, you want to know.
You are geeky, yeah.
Yeah, like, let's face it, we love you. You're amongst friends, you know. Yeah, it's true. My wife would have not much interest in whether or not it was 8 or 12 bit at this point, but yeah. I can tell you that the first place that I went to that was a full Cineon feature film pipeline was actually D-Film in Sydney during Dark City, and that was 98.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure. So is that right? Dark City was 98. And so that's, what, 5 years after this. So, and they weren't the – no, that was 3 years after this, right? Because this was 95.
It must have been still, yeah, in the days of like a lot of – well, I mean, in terms of proprietary file formats and stuff, I seem to remember some interesting PIX and PIS formats that were floating around at my workplace at the time too, which must have been pre-Cineon in terms of the adoption of that file format at sort of industry-wide for a while.
It's still extraordinary to me that Kodak did so much with Cineon and then walked away from it.
Yeah.
I just find that to be extraordinary. Okay, so Cineon was released in 83.
Oh, wow.
And was abandoned in 97.
Huh.
There you go. So that would be right. So the guys that were working at D-Film had adopted it because I think it was like a couple of years in production in about 96. And then that was it when it finished after that. But, yeah, so I don't know what was what films or productions were using Cineon, but now I'm going to have to totally find that out.
Yeah.
Who was using the actual machines. But, I mean, we totally owe Kodak a huge debt of gratitude for the Cineon file format. It was a huge leg up. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, my God, that's a huge bloody file.
So then, and then scanning back out then to film. I mean, obviously, this again, days before laser scanners both ways.
Yeah, well, the initial film scanners, interestingly, were a bloody great CRT with long exposures for each of the three colours.
Oh, okay.
So you would actually have a high-resolution, effectively black and white monitor with a different colour filter. So let's go back to the shots. So the sequencing, we always like to do this, the sequences that sort of stood out for you as being awesome, that just apart from the whole film, which we've obviously fully much established was awesome, what was, Matt, for you, sort of something that you remember even at the time going, wow, that really nailed it?
I mean, I love a lot of the shots, like I was saying before, of the rocket before takeoff in the direct sunlight, of a lot of which I guess were miniature shots. And then I thought a really great shot that I really liked was the shot of the rocket full frame at full thrust, still in the atmosphere right after they complete the roll maneuver. There's a great sort of where it's kind of crossing the frame at a diagonal, pointing sort of up.
Oh, you mean the shaky heat and like the seeking on a long lens shot?
Yeah, yeah. I just thought that was totally gorgeous. It's such a beautiful, beautiful shot. I really like that. And then I made a note too of some of the other stuff that I thought were really great were all the shots, I guess towards the tail end of the film, I really enjoyed all the shots of the really reflective command module. As it's getting closer and closer to re-entering the Earth's atmosphere, there's some just, you know, straight out of like, you know, For All Mankind or straight out of 2001 or even, you know, you can, I'm sure that Duncan Jones and those guys that made Moon were probably looking at this film as well. But there's some shots that are where the sun is coming around the corner of the Earth, and then you get these really just great reflections of both the sun and then of the edge of the Earth in the command module. Nice. And some of that stuff was just really incredibly beautiful. Looked totally real, you know.
What about for you, Justin?
I think just the launch sequence for me, just directorial, I guess the launch sequence is just, I mean, you can't go past that. I mean, I had long since before this came out loved a film, I think it's called Space Movie, which Mike Oldfield did music for. Have you ever seen that?
No.
It's I'm sure it's probably on YouTube, but it's essentially what it is a whole bunch of archival footage just set to Mike Oldfield kind of Tubular Bells sort of music. But it's almost like it's from camera roll. A lot of these shots are from camera roll through to like run out of this footage that we're used to seeing of the, you know, the rockets firing up and the, you know, the classic one of the sort of Apollo spacecraft going past through the camera with all the ice sort of falling off it on as it goes past the launch gantry.
Yeah,
but from go to woe. So I'd studied and seen all these microscopically studied and watched all of that footage. So to then see that launch sequence, and it's so emotional and it's so strong, and it's just it is a mammoth piece of filmmaking to what's obviously been so hard with this film for them is you're not just kind of dreaming up this spaceship and how it launches and how it works and, you know, the design of it. You are recreating something that people have lived and grown up with and watched frame by frame. So
one of the
it
most
makes it twice as hard.
Studied, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It makes it
most
twice as hard.
Kind of.
You know, people have seen all those sort of, you know, all the stuff that retracts back as the, you know, all the sort of CO2 cables and things that all pull back. All of this stuff is so ingrained in people's memories that I just find all of that is an absolute epic sort of piece of filmmaking, an epic sequence, and everything comes together there. That's live action, that's sort of pyro, CGI, music score. That's a fantastic. So can't go past. You know, it seems pretty obvious, but you can't.
No, look, I would have blamed the same thing. That shot traveling down as the ice is coming off.
Yeah,
it worked technically. It emotionally, for some reason, the downward movement as the, well, it feels like a downward movement as the rocket starts to go up and the ice is falling down.
Yeah,
just was unbelievably kind of emotionally impactful.
And all of those shots obviously really sort of typify that era where you've got that mix of, like the CGI of the ice particles versus classic kind of film matting to get all the sort of lighting passes, and then you know, full on bigatures of in motion control of the launch of the whole launch vehicle going past. So it's, you know, nowadays, of course, obviously the entire thing would be CGI, and you could just go on the internet and download the whole Apollo 3D model, you know, and you know, people would be on YouTube in half an hour. So we've come a long way.
I have to say that you're right. The level of technology was so much stuff. You know, the first shot when they're over the top of the construction building, I guess it is, where the rocket is, and goes across the top of a building, and it sort of looks down and then around.
Yeah.
And then inside the doorway is a comped shot of a miniature.
I think that's what amazes me about this film, is that this is the first time, the first time that I really noticed that sort of comping lives, you know, like chopper shots, essentially gyro-stabilized chopper shots of an empty warehouse, and then dropping in on the move a MoCo miniature, sort of match moving that sort of stuff, which
I made a note of that shot too. That was one that I don't think, when the film first came out, I don't think I even noticed it. You know,
Matt, just so you know, that shot took them forever. That one shot, and I'll tell you why, because they didn't have the skills we had now for 3D tracking. So that was like a one-point
track. It's all by hand, right?
Corner. No, you could track it.
One-point
tracking. Right. But the trouble is, you track the bottom corner and the top would seem to sway, like the rocket would seem to sway. You track the top and the bottom wouldn't. And I remember them just having to like spend enormous numbers of hours trying to get that one shot to actually work in perspective.
Well, that was pretty wide too, right? Like, so there must have been some lens distortion in that as well, you know?
Oh, God. It was just, yeah. I mean, I just think how hard that shot was to do back in the day. And now, then you think.
So if you're going to do that today now, I guess, and you shoot your aerial shot, then you can then track that. And put tracking points all over it in the computer, and then that you can use that information to feed that in. First of all, obviously, you do all of it in CGI, but second of all, you could then use information from tracking to feed that to motion control, so your move could exactly
quite frankly, you wouldn't do it that way. You'd shoot the live action plate. You would have no tracking markers. You would just shoot the environment. You'd do a 3D track. That would produce a 3D camera move.
Yep.
And then you'd produce a CG rocket, which would drop in over the top of the doorway hole.
Sure.
Where it was difficult is two pieces of live action, which is, you're absolutely right. Like, it would be great if you could just do a 3D track, and the whole 3D track would then feed your motion control rig to produce the three-dimensional move. But we didn't have, like, the film Twister didn't have 3D tracking. It had hand trackers. It had guys sitting there that did it by hand. And so you could do a one-point track which would nail A to B, but you couldn't get like a full three-dimensional sort of build-up of the entire thing. So that shot coming over the top of the building looking down into the front door, that was matched as much as you possibly could. But in the end, you could stabilize it but not kind of perfectly.
You have to do frame by frame stabilizing, or literally would be stabilizing.
Well, the problem was you basically had to form a bicubic patch. So basically, four corners. Imagine the four corners are stretchable, and at that point, it wasn't. You couldn't get inside the bicubic patch, so you could basically have a four corner patch. Now you could stretch and animate the patch any which way you liked. So you'd nail down the corner, and then you'd kind of hand animate the top corners to make the perspective kind of match, knowing that the floor was anchored to the floor. But again, the problem is you need those points to be exactly in the same physical space. So you've got a live-action plate going into a live-action plate where you're warping the top live-action plate on a sort of four-point warp to try to make it go in. And then you just get a really good artist to work on it for a really long time. I mean, it was, you know, to take nothing away from Flame, but it was just, that's what it was. You know?
Yeah, and remember watching both of those shots, like the shots tracking, the aerial shot over the crawler that you mentioned that Ron Howard was driving, which is just an empty crawler, and there's shots literally sort of aerial moves.
Does it pivot around that three-dimensional?
Yeah,
it was more like a travelling shot.
There is a little bit of a pan.
Because there's a huge perspective shift in the going over the top of the building shot.
Yeah, it's not so much. It is a little bit of a sort of a circling around it, but nonetheless, it's still, you know, tracking perspectively, that would be an absolute bitch with the Saturn rocket sitting on top of that and tracking it, and you can't see any shift between the two. You expect there'll be some sort of wobble, but it's amazing. So I think that was I think a real achievement.
What did you guys think of the footage that they did that sort of was the Jim Lovell dream sequence where he imagines walking on the moon? How did you guys feel about that stuff?
I liked the thing that struck me was the composition of the moon dust when he puts his hand in it, which is a completely live action thing. So I'm sure that's not what you're referring to. Mm-hmm. But I think I thought it was good. I can't remember being. What are you? Is there something that was?
No, it's the one. It's the one sequence that I was thinking about in the film that, you know, it's the one. I think it's the one just pure fantasy sequence, right? Like, it doesn't have any, you know, it's clearly trying to replicate and be based in reality, but it's not something that actually transpired other than
in
his own mind,
his
right?
His wife's nightmare scene.
It's his wife. That's what I was.
Right.
Loss of cabin pressure and the whole thing explodes and Jim gets blasted out into space.
Where they build an entire bed standing up so that she can lie in the bed standing up so they can get the eye shot, and then they're cut out before they use it.
The dream sequences I largely just kind of blank out, or they're just sort of, they don't sort of stick in my memory. I mean, I guess they're sort of, kind of, I can see narratively where they're sort of, you know.
I guess the reason I bring it up is I think that's actually something that is, or at least at that time, it still seemed like it's something that was kind of tough, was trying to really get and replicate. I know it's one of the hardest things to do or a difficult thing to do in animation. If you're animating a character, to make it look like they're walking in a low gravity environment, but getting an actor in a costume to be moving in a space like that on a stage, looking like they're moving in a low gravity environment, I don't feel like it really worked as well as some of the other stuff, but it was interesting to see that in its in that time, in that context.
Yeah, it's. I don't think now, actually, if those were gone, you probably wouldn't need them. You don't really need them in there to set up the fact that this is a mission that people are worried about, and there's a chance of loss of life.
Yeah, I think it'd be a 135-minute movie instead of 140 minutes, right?
Yeah, it's.
I mean, look, I think you needed to capture the sense of how important it was, but I think you got that directorially by that scene where they're going around the moon and the guys say, do you want to look? And Tom Hanks sits back in the cockpit and says, I've seen it, and doesn't even go to the window because it's so painful to be that close again.
Well, that's one of those things. I think that's what I was saying before too, about the script being so efficient. Like it does it already, you know, it's already set it. And there are a few times where, you know, if I was going to be critical, and I do like this movie a good deal, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but I do think there are instances like that where there are things that are maybe redundant, you know, where we've already seen it or we've already had it sort of delivered to us through exposition, and so it comes, I think the film comes in a little long in that regard.
Yeah. Let's discuss Ron Howard, shall we? Because I wanted to do that. Ron Howard, I think, is one of the most collaborative filmmakers around. He has this saying, I heard him talk, he says, basically, when you go on set or when you're involved in filmmaking, you need to approach each day assuming the people you're dealing with are basically talented, smart people who love movies. And if you just assume that all the people that are there with you are talented, smart people who love movies, then you just have a good life, right? And I think it's this kind of positive projection of the world that works well for him. I mean, you know, you tend to think of him, of course, as just being a nice guy, because apart from the fact that we sort of knew him in his actor days as being a character who was a nice
Richie
guy.
Richie Cunningham.
You know, you never see anything in the press about Ron Howard as a director in anything other than glowing terms, and he always just seems to be, you know, an actor's director because of his own acting background. But I know that Rob Legato said that when Ron Howard came to him on Apollo 13, they had not storyboard frames, this is what we want you to make, but this is a sequence. In fact, he actually says this, I think, in Cinefix. If you're looking up this issue, it's number 63. And, of course, we love Cinefix because it's magnificent. He says that he would come to him with ideas and say, so what do you think? And interestingly, when I separately heard Ron Howard talking, I got Ron Howard's point of view on this, or I heard Ron Howard's point of view. He wasn't talking to me directly. But rather than go to someone like Rob Legato and say, here's what we were kind of thinking, like the rocket separates here, what do you think? Not having any ideas of his own, Ron Howard actually meticulously researches what he wants, completely gets exactly, almost shot for shot, exactly what he wants, and then he puts it to one side. And his in this talk he gave, his point of view was, look, I already know what I want. I already know what I've thought of. I've already got my good ideas. Now, I don't want to stop somebody else from coming up with a better idea. So rather than go to them and say, look at my idea, because I want to show them how clever I am kind of thing, he would say, okay, so the rocket separates here. What do you think? Completely pushing his own stuff into the background, just opening himself up for the better idea to come along. And he pointed out that not only does this mean that occasionally someone comes up with a much better idea than he's already thought of, but if somebody doesn't come up with anything better, well, he's already got a good idea, right? Like, it's not like he doesn't know what he's doing. He has that already. He can only go up from here. But also, if somebody gets... Well, two things. Firstly, if somebody is in that environment, he reckons it's easier to say no to them, because if somebody's been actively engaged in the process and then you have to say no to them on something, then they're okay to go with it because they feel like they've been heard. But the second thing, which he called his six of one, half a dozen of the other rule, is that if you came up with an idea that was equivalent to his, similar, maybe a bit different, he would normally go with your idea because you would own that idea. You would completely not only own that idea, but understand that idea. So instead of you'd approach the shot by, well, I believe this is what Ron wants, sort of like this is what Ron wants, you'd be like, this is what I think will work, and then you would make it work because it's, you know, it's yours and you understand it.
And they can run with it and they can leave you alone and, you know, and so, make that their own.
Exactly. So he's like, and he uses a story of like the analogy of the brown box. He's like, you know, on some sets, a director will be like, get me a guy with a brown box to walk through the back of frame. And then somebody walks through with the brown box that's the wrong brown box. And then you yell at them, that's a stupid brown box. I don't know what that bloody brown box. Go get a bloody big brown box like this, blah, blah, blah. And they go, oh, shit, sorry. And they go off looking for the box that the director yelled at them
Which
to get.
Which brown box is right.
But Ron tries to sense up an environment. He goes, I want a funny brown or some kind of box carried through the back of frame. And then the person kind of might come in with a giraffe. And like a giraffe might be funnier because it's a funny scene. And that he had never opened himself up to a giraffe. He just had a box because that's all he got to.
Yeah.
Now, if he decides that the box is what he does want for some other reason, plot reason, whatever, well, then obviously he'll communicate that. But he opens himself up to that left of field guy carrying a giraffe in the back of frame for no apparent reason. That's just genius that we all kind of love. And I guess I want to ask, start with you, Jason. Like, I mean, it must be really hard as a director to not want to fall into a world of having everybody else be doing what you want, which of course is a Hitchcock type approach. You know, it's all storyboard and just make this, but that isn't collaborative and it isn't really probably going to get the best out of it.
I've just been, I guess, it's something that comes, I guess, with experience. You have to be wrong enough times following your own path to work out that sometimes other people have a better idea than yourself. You know, I've had other people's ideas much better than my own enough to realize that they're worth, you know, worth relying on. I think if I'd completely been this amazing Hitchcock director where my vision was always right and my shelf was lined with Oscars, then
well, interestingly, Hitchcock's shelf was never lined with Oscars. And, no, but I might actually point out that maybe that was because in a collaborative filmmaking environment, his potential collaborators didn't collaborate and kind of didn't warm to him for that reason, and they never responded with an Oscar.
Yeah, look, I constantly want to surround myself with people who are going to bring input and not going to be a yes man and just going to bring something to the table. Otherwise, literally, I might as well just do it myself. You know, have an editor that's going – I mean, particularly I was – think of it more with editors that I would not necessarily almost don't give them the storyboard and let them take the footage, or at least choose an editor who's going to take that footage and just completely ignore what your board was anyway and give you something new. You might not like the whole edit, but you might like a couple of things the way that works brilliantly that you hadn't thought of. Otherwise, literally just get yourself a book on how to edit and get an edit assistant. You know, if you're not going to use these people for their own input, then just, you know, crew yourself with a bunch of robots. People have there's a lot of collective experience on your set, and just surround yourself with people that are kind of think like you do, and let them do what they do.
Matt, you've worked on a lot of big films, and without naming any individual ones, is there a sense of the director's collaborative or non-collaborative vibe that permeates down to the troops, do you think?
Well, I think it depends, and I think, you know, I totally concur with what both you and Jason have been saying. I think, you know, when it's all said and done, I think, you know, filmmaking is, it's a team sport. You know, you can draw the analogy to any, you know, whether it's football is probably a good analogy, right? American football, I'm thinking of, sorry. You know, something like conducting an orchestra, right? You've got all the people in the orchestra playing all their different instruments, the different sections, some soloists, and there's a sheet of music in front of you, and everybody's sort of trying to adhere to the timing and the pace and the sheet of music, and the conductor is up there trying to keep pace and lead that orchestra. But everyone is bringing their own skill set to the table, and I think it's a smart director, a confident filmmaker is somebody who's going to come to that process and be able to encourage and help draw out the best of the people that they're working with. I mean, I keep making this analogy, but I mean, this film is a perfect one to bring up even in the subject matter that we're talking about, in that, you know, you look at all the events that transpire over the course of this narrative in this film. And I think that what's happening in this movie is, based on the true story, you know, when they have to build that filter, right? The famous part of the story where they have to build that filter to get the round peg to go into the square hole. And the way in which all the different members of the team who specialize in a particular aspect of, you know, said mission, wind up sort of pulling out all the stops, and they like dump everything out on the table. And there's that great moment where they say, you know, we've got to figure out how to get this to fit in here, with using only these things. Right. And they have to figure out how to do this. And at the same time, draft a list of instructions that can be followed by the astronauts in the ship. So they can do this thing. So they don't, so they make it back to Earth. And I think that, you know, that analogy for filmmaking, it's the same. And, you know, I find certainly in my own career, the projects where, I've been, you know, in a more senior position, obviously I have much more interaction with the director and I get to have, a greater deal of input. And I would certainly say that for me and, or then for anybody who's working on my team, if the director has been really collaborative and asked, specifically, you know, well, what do you think? Or what do you guys think? Even when the director comes by and gets a chance to go by, you know, individual artists' workstations and critique and look at a shot that an artist has, to have a director go on rounds at a facility with a supervisor, I think is a great idea for a lot of reasons. It, you know, there's some sticky situations. There's always the potential for something unfortunate to transpire in that short amount of time. But most of the time, everybody's pretty professional. And I think that it actually raises everyone's game because everyone feels much more involved in the process and feels that their input and their, that it really is a true collaboration. You know, you're not just a, you know, a textile worker in a factory, you know?
I mean, I think the thing that about that football analogy, it's obviously heavily worn, but I do think there's one really valid point about it, which is I see the director as the coach on the sideline. And I think this is significant because I don't see the director as, to use the American analogy, the quarterback on the field. And the reason is this, you know, the director can't actually get in there. I mean, obviously some can, but you can't get in there and actually do the shot. So you have to set things in motion and then step back and watch them played out. And the second thing is that I got a feeling that there's a, it's not like it's a, maybe it's ego, but it's this thing about, No, but I think the thing is people go, I need to have the answers because I am the guy at the top of the pyramid. And so if I don't have the answers, it'll seem like the ship is rudderless. Where, of course, when you're not at the top of the ship or the top of the pyramid, you would love to be able to contribute to the film and wouldn't see the director asking for your input as a sign of weakness. But when you reverse it around, if you are, you know, in front of the team and somebody says, does the ship go left or right, to say, I don't know, what do you think? You know, is the kind of hallmark of not knowing, hence not being the creative genius that has all the answers, hence sort of weakness. I mean,
you do have to have that back, as you said with Ron, you have to have that back research and have your own answers off to one side. Right. So that when people do come up with their own reasons, you have to, you can't just say, no, that's rubbish. You have to at least keep that collaborative gate open by saying why it doesn't work.
Yeah, you have to be able to articulate your perspective.
You have to know the back characters or know the story or what's happening in the next scene so that when someone says, suggests something, you have to be able to, you know, have to give a reason why no rather than just flat out no. Otherwise, they will not offer up something up the next time.
Okay, so Ron Howard famously describes the three stages of filmmaking as being the will they ever let me make this film stage, which is pre, followed by the production stage, which is why the hell did I want to do this, followed by the post-production stage, which is what moron made this piece of crap and how can we fix it?
I love the fact that he's so brutally honest. I just love it. It's just, it makes you all sort of seem so human.
I just wonder, though, is Ron Howard able to be that collaborative and that relaxed, apart from the fact that, you know, we said he's probably a really nice guy. He's obviously worked and knows and has benefited from very strong relationships with people like Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas,
Roger Corman. Roger Corman makes a cameo, by the way, in the movie. I don't know if you saw that at the beginning of the film. And Corman gave Ron Howard his first start in the movie business in 1977 with Grand Theft Auto.
But I'm wondering whether it's also because he has Brian Grazier to one side. Because Brian Grazier is a take a you know, baseball bat to your knee kind of producer. No, but really, it's like he's no man. Okay, he's no one's fool. He's incredibly savvy, and surely he would be doing the heavy lifting with the negotiations that allows Ron to not do that.
Mm. He makes and he's got that Sid Vicious haircut dressed, too.
Yeah, and he made a cameo in Entourage, but that's all by and by. I just wonder, like, do you need to have somebody to be that open and relaxed, or is it just that if you're that bloody famous, successful, and good, you can afford to sit back and
you always need a great producer to have your back. Just sort of, if you've got a great idea, imagine. I mean, look at what Grazer would have had to do for this film. The KC-135, they had the Vomit Comet for a month.
They got access. An aircraft carrier.
They got access to aircraft carriers. The two Navy Sea King choppers. They took away the numbers on the front of those and replaced them with decals on the front of these to match the exact 66 and whatever they matched the. So it's the same numbers on the recovery choppers. Getting those aircraft, changing their decals, getting access to the aircraft, getting on board Vomit Comet for a month. Can you imagine what the booked schedule would be for a zero-G simulator for a month? Building sets in there, doing stuff that's never been done before. This is way before, Michael Bay sort of could take over NASA and command the entire...
Behind every American great director Navy. Is a good, scary, steely little producer.
As three professionals, wouldn't we each cut off our own leg to work with Ron Howard? And would we say the same thing about Brian Grazer?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, you would say the same thing about both? Because I just feel, and I've never worked with him, but I would just feel like it would be the experience of a career to work with Ron Howard.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm scared of Brian. Even this podcast, I'm scared that he's going to find out where I live.
But yeah, look, you have to have that kind of guy getting your back to be able to then let that sort of stuff, like, I really want to have this, you know, the Vomit Comet for a month, or I need to have it. You can't work it out. That's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, a good producer is going to give you that creative freedom to really sort of like spread your wings and be able to sort of figure out how to solve problems creatively where you're not having to worry about and deal with
the
complex logistical issues. Like, you're really just thinking creatively about the art of making the film, you know?
Yes. But I think when Rob Legato sort of went, I think we should ditch any use of any actual footage and to replicate the whole lot, even though it's some of the best known, most analyzed, most studied footage of the modern era, that Rob Legato did that, at least in part, because he's in the collaborative, supportive working environment that a Ron Howard just seems to ooze out with such ease. Because, that's a balls up kind of, I mean, that call when he made it in 95 was pretty, you know, hardcore.
Could well be. If you were Rob Legato, you'd want to, and you got the opportunity. Well, do we give these guys the chance to build Apollo, an Apollo launch vehicle and pyro it into the sky? Yeah. Or do we just give you guys some, let you do some cleanups and grain reduction on?
No, I'm sorry. I think Rob Legato really was coming at this not from a point of, say anything you like about Rob Legato, but I actually think he was totally behind what was best for the film. It wasn't like we want to have fun with rockers.
Sure.
I think you're right, but I would say that I think, you know, we got to face facts too, right? I mean, this is a tentpole movie for the studio in this particular year that this came out, and also I think, you know, for these men and women that go out and direct these big movies, you know, I mean, what is the draw on some level? Like, I mean, one of it is, you know, the love and craft of filmmaking and, you know, creating art and whatnot. But I do think a big part of the draw too, and I mean, I would hope you guys would agree with me. I mean, it's super fun, right? I mean, in 1995, to get the budget, the stars, the great script, the great story, the great, you know, a great director, a great visual effects supervisor and crew, and to be able to go out and say, you know what, we've got an opportunity here to go play in one kick-ass sandbox, you know, like, let's see what we can do.
I think Ron Howard's quoted is actually saying this is his favorite film of all the films he's done. Mm. And I get you. I just think, I don't think it's the majority of productions that has this collaborative environment. And I'm wondering, you know, Jason? Like, where is it? Is it just in a million little places, or do you need to make a stand at some point to kind of set the tone for these sorts of things? I mean, when you're directing, like when you're working, and obviously with actors as much as with VFX supervisors, right? I mean, Ron Howard, as we know from all the stuff he did after this, complete NASA nut, you know, does Earth to the Moon, which I think is one of the best HBO miniseries ever.
Yeah.
But he does just a ton of other stuff, documentary and otherwise.
Mm, historical. Mm. Well, I think you have to, I go back to the football coach thing, you do have to be that sort of, you can't be right in the middle of the field conducting the whole thing, being the quarterback. You have to get back and watch the, I'm not a sports person, so I'm going to sort of stumble here. But you have to be watching the whole play so that you can see, now that was terrific, now stop it, that was great. Let's go back. What you did here and what you did there, that was terrific. You forget that, whatever. Just follow this guy and cherry pick the best bits and then let them still play with it. You have to sit back, watch what people do, and then and then take the sort of great plays from what you saw, I guess. And you just have to I go back to the fact that you have to have that back knowledge and research. You do have to sort of do your homework or have your own vision to then to be able to compare it with what's new and say which is better, and not, as you say, not have an ego. You can't, I mean, I guess the whole thing about wanting to be a director or whatever is there must be some ego under there, but you just can't, you got to let that be what gets you to the top of the call sheet, but not what lets you trample on everyone below you to get there. Does that make sense? On set, you can't. Yeah. You have to – that two-way street of collaboration is something that's so easily cut off just by treating people the wrong way. And so, well, this guy, you know, he just completely blanked my idea, so screw you. Next time you won't ask him for my opinion and just say, I don't know, you tell me. You have to keep that – you have to foster that sort of two-way street thing, and it comes from how you handle – you have to set it up from the very beginning. It's a very hard thing to sort of say how you do that, but you have to let people know that you are open to it, and then when they do offer it up, not just shut it down or give them a good reason for shutting down what they say, and do it nicely and without ego, really, I think. Otherwise, actors aren't going to give you the performance other than what you ask for. No one's going to give you anything other than what you ask for if you just constantly just push back on their ideas. There has to be good reasons.
So, Matt, you've worked at some of the best facilities in the world, ILM, Escape, Tibbet, you've done Weta, just like Sony, SBI. So let me ask you this. Is there a – no, this is not where I'm going with it. I'm saying you've worked at some of the best facilities in the world. Is there a predominantly feature facility culture of collaboration, or is it a directorially set thing? When we get into the facility level – now we're not on set like Jason was discussing.
Mm.
Do you think that is a culture that is just, this is how it feels when I'm walking around at X facility versus on this production, the director just, it was awesome?
I think that's an excellent question. And I guess my answer to that would be twofold. I think that I would make the case that in the past, I think there was a much greater opportunity, no matter what facility you're at, for that to occur, for there to be a opportunity for some more exciting and interesting collaboration. I still think it happens. I think it still does exist. But I think that, and some facilities still greatly encourage this, some more than others. But I would say that I think it's becoming less and less the case for the average, be it lighter or compositor to participate in a production in that way. I think it's less and less the case at some of the bigger facilities, just in part because they have become so big, and the money that is going through some of the big facilities on some of the really big pictures is so much bigger. And I think that they become more stratified and much more hierarchical, because they have to be, you know. I think that so it limits some of that. It just depends on where you are in that hierarchy, I suppose. The degree to which you feel more intimately involved with the production. But that being said, I mean, I feel like this is an easy one to mention because it doesn't exist anymore, but ESC Entertainment, when they were around in Alameda, California, was one of the most exciting and interesting places to work. It was like the Wild West. I mean, they were reinventing everything, rebuilding a pipeline and working on the two Matrix sequels at the same time. And it felt like a big facility. It had Warner Brothers behind it and pumping the money into it for those projects. And the things that were happening there were exciting, and there were people who came in as just like a technical director and wound up leading sequences and stuff, and had no expectation that that's what they were going to do, but they were helping to build and develop a totally new kind of pipeline in order to execute the work that was required for a given set of shots. And we're being led by guys like Kim Labrary and George Murphy and some really great effects supervisors, and it was an exciting place. And a place like that was really great, and then it disappears. But then other things come to the fore. I think that's a complicated question to answer, and I don't know if it's one that I don't think there's a universal truth that could be stated about that. If you're a visual effects artist, I think it's very different. It's different from facility to facility. It can be different from project to project. And the size of the project, I think, can dictate some of the degree to which you can have a greater sense of, I just want to say ownership, I guess, over the work that you're doing, and a sense of involvement in that respect.
Well, I didn't work there. I visited there. I knew people that worked there, but I absolutely didn't work there. So I only offer this as a passing opinion. But I'd have to say, walking onto the lot of Digital Domain in Santa Monica in 90, whatever it was, when they were doing Apollo 13, I think I was much more aware of the Scott Ross culture of this was the most interesting place in the entire visual effects galaxy at that instant in time than I was of any Ron Howard influence. Mm-hmm. I think Ron Howard's influence I was not even aware of. But then I wasn't on the film, and I bet you that Rob Legato had an enormous amount of influence. So I think that it's probably the answer is somewhere in the middle, that I think if you have someone as influentially visionary and as stand-up kind of... Because the thing about Scott Ross, unlike, say, Jim Cameron or one of the other founders of DD, I mean, Scott Ross was actually running the darn thing, and he's ex-ILM, is that he had an opinion. He had a position, and it made for about the most exciting place on the galaxy. I just couldn't. The distance between the Whale boardroom and the sound stages at DD for me was the most interesting place on the planet. And I mean, there was just nowhere else that you wanted to walk between.
Do you think the current culture, the current sort of fragmentation of shops where a film like this today would be handed out to sort of 10 shops? And the schedules, and do you think that is it all the more harder to get this kind of collaborative version? Would the version of Apollo 13 shot tomorrow be a very different film?
Okay, I will say no. If you are at DNEG on the day they start work on Inception, where someone like Paul Franklin is collaborating with the filmmaker on a film that is an original production, so it's not like, again, one of these things where you're sort of going off the graphic art of a novel. Mm-hmm. So it's an original look to be developed. Mm. You've worked with them, the director, on multiple other really good projects. And let's face it, like someone like Rob Legato was, very well linked with DD, obviously. I mean, they did so much DD stuff. There's a lot of history that you can't move beyond. It's really important that you've got that great working relationship. And so you've got a Dark Knight under your belt. You've got like the proven track record, and you've got a brand new, breathtakingly interesting project like Inception. Sure. I bet you the space between the render farm and the boardroom of DNEG was a hell of a place to be the day that that Inception got greenlit. And
that's probably more the exception than the rule, I suppose, in today's kind of build-to-order kit form.
But DNEG was the principal and primary supplier on that film.
Yeah,
it was
right,
not,
right.
Some sort of, X
which is rare more?
It's, I think there's a pendulum swing. Like, let's not forget, Weta tends to be primary house on on a Jackson film in a way that, you know, ILM is on a Lucasfilm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you've got, I mean, I think if, look, if you had War of the Worlds at ILM, which I think ILM was like, did almost all the effects on, if you have Kong at Weta, or for that matter, Lord of the Rings, if you had, you know, Inception at DNEG, like those are those, you know, projects. I mean, being able to pick those projects and get on them is just killer. But I think, I think that's possible. Mm. I think, though, that you would be, I do
it
think.
It is harder now, though.
It is harder. And, yeah, because there's, but then there's a lot more visual effects, right?
You have a crew on a visual effects film, like the crew on Avatar, the crew on King Kong. The crew, just for the effects alone, is twice or three times the size, if not more, than the average film crew.
Oh, God. Total. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, and, yeah. And let's face it, on Apollo, there was, we said, 200 shots, right? So if there are 200 shots, you were referring to every shot by its name, as in, like, nickname. Yeah. You're like, I'm doing the hangar
sequence
shot.
And the number.
You would have, yeah. But no, on you know,
one, two,
a big...
5/AA15B.
Yeah, and I was just on I can't talk about it because it's embargo, but I was just, you know, because we get invited onto a lot of things way before they get public. Mm-hmm. And so I was walking around a big house, and they were talking about shots, and it was a complicated 12-minute sequence. And that 12-minute sequence alone, it would have had more than 200 shots in it. And, you know, so, and they did a bloody great job, and I'm really looking forward to when the film comes out and we can talk about it. It's going to be awesome next year. But, and the concept art, everything about it was magnificent. But they got one 12-minute sequence out of a bunch of stuff. I guess I would say we're completely discounting, like, the Pixar experience. Like, if you were on a Pixar film...
Right. That's totally different, though. Yeah, I mean, it's a wholly different kind of endeavor. And I think even people at Pixar, the people that run Pixar, would say that, you know, the people that they like to get in-house, you know, they don't hire a lot of people from visual effects, you know, in general, like people who
and
work.
Also, and also, I've been talking to recruiters lately, and you go to Pixar, you don't come out. They stay. Yeah. They're happy.
And you look at this, but the interesting is the collaborative, that timeline is how much they actually spend storyboarding and evolving the film, and how much actual time in the, say, 2 year, 3 year, whatever of the lifespan of a film, how much time they actually spent evolving storyboards and script versus how much time they actually spend finally.
Yeah, and they're not a vendor either, right? I mean, they're a progenitor. They're a studio. They're not a vendor for effects. Like, they are a studio.
Studio, yeah, production Disney, house, and effects house, and everything.
Yeah. But you know, the we need more Ed Catmulls. We need more Scott Rosses. You know, these are the guys that...
Legatos.
Well, so, but I'd put Rob in a slightly different category because he's a VFX supervisor, not a general manager of a facility. And I think you need both. I think you want, definitely, obviously, desperately want the really good VFX supervisors that have the balls out kind of... I mean, to tackle Titanic, Rob Legato needed, you know, possibly quite the largest balls in VFX. That was just unbelievable.
Titanic, I mean, balls.
2 years after this, they're doing Titanic. Oh, my God.
Mm.
You know, a pre-production meeting of which somebody actually says, should we just build an exact one-to-one scale replica of the Titanic and sink it?
And then
they discuss it because it's actually a viable option.
Mike, just out of curiosity, did you at SIGGRAPH this last year, did you get a chance to see Jim Morris's keynote?
I did
not. Speaking of general managers, he was general manager at ILM the entire time that I was there. And he's another one of those guys that I think...
I met him in Sydney at a BES event, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Jim is another.
He was a great GM, and I think he really had, and I think still does have as in his producer's role at Pixar, but has just such a good attitude about sort of the... kind of being a very egalitarian about the way that he engages with all the people that he works with. And I think that's something
that... You can miss the Jims and the Eds and the Scots by going straight to the John Lasseters, the, you know, Jim Camerons and the, you know, George Lucases. And I do honestly believe that to get that good collaborative vibe and a visual effects facility, you need both. You need the director to not be a dick, and you need the facility manager to be embracive of a culture that just supports failure and supports success.
I totally agree.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that you exactly have like a DD with Inception.
So, I look, we can't go on all day, though I'd love to. But I will just say that I want to thank you, Matt, so much for taking time out to talk to us. And you, Jason.
Oh, my pleasure.
It really is not in any way less than a sheer pleasure to sit around and discuss a film this good with two people that I respect as much as you guys. So thank you so much.
Can I quickly mention a couple of things people probably should just research if you haven't seen? Research, buy, book, read, download, listen to. Particularly what we've, Mike and I, which you put me onto a couple of years ago, is which is that fantastic USC, the School of Cinematic Arts podcast that Ron Howard did.
I don't think it's actually any available anymore. Last time I went to look at it, I would have recommended it myself, but he just...
I think I just saw a link to it. Forgive me if I'm wrong.
That's great.
School of Cinematic Arts podcast.
The USC one, where Ron Howard discusses a lot of the things we've been talking about today. And in fact,
I'm sure if it's not there, it'll be somewhere else to be able to track down. It is a brilliant discussion about everything collaborative, not necessarily VFX, but cinematography.
I've got to listen to that one. I haven't heard that.
And it is just sensational talk. And just if you don't love him beforehand, you're going to really love him when you finish doing that. Also would be, which is the basis of this film, is a book called Lost Moon, written by Jim Lovell. So he's actually credited as kind of a co-writer of Apollo 13,
right,
because of this book being sort of the basis. And that is a fantastic read because that's written by the guy that did it. This is not some sort of recreational sort of novel from somebody else. Also, what I was talking about, the space movie, which is awesome, maybe YouTube, that's just like, you know, sit down, glass of red, and just if you can find it on DVD, even better. It's just like, and of course, Apollo 13 DVD special edition, the making of is just sensational.
Super great, yeah.
If you ever watched it, the particularly for just directorially, I just love watching the great bit of an interview, which was from a documentary of Gene Kranz, the NASA mission commander, I guess, that Ed Harris plays. emotionally misting up over talking about when Apollo 13 came back home and how Ron saw that and fed that back as a performance notes for Ed Harris. And
that's so a great moment in the movie when he says in the film, I think this is going to be our finest hour. You know, like that's a great moment.
And the other actor's reaction to that, he's almost shamed into a head nod of like, yes, of course. I don't know what I'm saying.
And can I just say, I think that was almost completely on par with Apollo 11 actually making it to the moon, was Apollo 13 actually getting back from where they were. I think that is an absolute shining moment in NASA.
You know,
and
just I was five.
I'm in human achievement.
I was five when this happened, and at my primary school, the junior school, I remember them drawing a big Earth and moon on the blackboard and drawing figure of eights around them. And I had no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
It wasn't until later that memory came back to me and I realized that they must have been, because it was all in the news and for like several days there, the world was transfixed with it. Mm. They were trying to explain to us as to what the hell was going on.
Yeah, I just remember seeing pictures of a fire in the hold, or that was it, and that was about it. And by that stage, it all happened and all been done.
You mean
I remember some sort of photo in history books flipping through in my sort of NASA geekery, but that is it of all of my memory. Until this came back into pop culture, you realize that not only is it an incredibly amazing achievement for NASA and mankind, but man, the story is just built for Hollywood to grab. This is just how it plays out in real life. It's just made to be turned into
unbelievable. Hey, two quick things. I know we're running long, and if anybody's still listening, I just want to mention two quick things before. Michael Light has a book called Full Moon, which all photography from this these missions
book,
from this era, it is incredible. There's almost no text in the book. There's only maybe one page or two pages of text. It is more like an artist monograph. It is a gorgeous, gorgeous book.
Okay, this is not something you want to get from iBooks. This is you need to physically have this book.
It's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
I've got it sitting right here on my desk.
Yeah, the backstory is that this writer essentially went back into, almost one of the first people to actually go back into the NASA archives and with trepidation and under, you know, armed guard, get access to the original pieces of celluloid that went through the Apollo 11, all the Apollo.
All right. Well, okay. So I'll top you on that one.
And then
that was a good one.
Get them and scan them beautifully.
You get a chance, you've got to see to cut you off, because that is brilliant, right?
Yeah, it is brilliant.
But a lot of the footage that we saw for the Apollo landing was based on stuff shot not at 24 frames a second. Because they couldn't reload the film, they decided to shoot, you know, less film. But of course, in the day, they just played it back in real time. Mm. So a lot of the stuff that you saw was sped up.
Like old Keystone Cops, but without playing it back at 24.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And so so there was a lot of interesting work done. Well, you'd know about this, Matt, at ILM, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In recreating from the using 3D tracking technology the actual landing on the moon to try and get a reconstruction in the right time
right
frame,
time
where a second is a second.
Right, because it does always look like, you know, he's jumping, he's, you know, obviously they're all, yeah, you see it on, the, it is like comical, comical Keystone Cops on the moon when they're all jumping around. As you say, they're all shooting it at 16 frames to save for footage and the amount of film they needed to take with them and then bring back. Save weight, every gram was really, really important getting up there. Every gram took, you know, whatever, $1 million to get it up there.
Well, yeah, because it would, because, you know, that's what it would take. Like, and so John Knoll actually did a whole lot of that reconstruction stuff as a personal project. Wow. And if you ever get the chance to see John's stuff on this, it's just unbelievably good.
Did it go anywhere? I mean, was it
well,
used in
here's the interesting thing. Like, they, you know, the okay, we're really in a rat hole now. They took the data tapes from the original trajectory landing.
Yep.
And recycled the tapes.
Right.
So they're gone. So John got hold of the original paper printouts, and then he scanned the printouts and then used that to derive the trajectories and then did 3D tracking and worked it all out. It was a huge personal project of his.
Right.
And and the other one I was going to say, because we've gone down the rat hole, is you've completely opened me up to one of the things we're trying to do, crossover, cross-promotion, over at Red Center. Because at Matt, I don't know if you've heard Red Center, but the podcast that Jason do, that we were at SIDGRAPH and we were talking to someone about doing really, really interesting stuff with sensor calibration on 5Ds and stuff. You know, it seemed like a reasonable thing. And and this chap, Lee Peterson, was giving a talk about sensor calibration, and the session moved, and I met Lee at when he turned up to give his session, only to be told that it had been moved. And I said, look, I'm really sorry that we can't see your session right now because I can't see it to the time they've moved it to. But as you clearly had nothing to do for the next hour because you meant to be talking, can I and my mates buy you a coffee and we could just talk to you about this because we're really, you know, geeks and we want to talk about sensor calibration. And Lee generously said, sure. So we went off to a quiet corner and bought coffee. And we're going through this. Stop me. Well, I'm going to tell the story anyway. I can't be stopped. We're going through this story with Lee. And I'm like, consider myself pretty geeky, and I consider myself hardcore on sensors. This is like, you know, I'm on my own turf.
He was
here,
impressed. Right? Even the NASA guy was impressed that you're questioning. He was not expecting to
well,
be.
Well, no, but that wasn't my point of mentioning that. My point was, at some point, I was so flawed with how good Lee was. I mean, he just knew stuff beyond anything that I was like able to find out anywhere on the net or talking to anyone. I mean, it was really hardcore stuff. And I stopped about halfway through talking to him about sensor calibration. I said, Lee, I've got to ask you this. How do you know this stuff? Because this is stuff that's really obscure and no one knows this stuff. I mean, this is like, did you, before I could finish the sentence, he said, well, well, I guess after I finished the Apollo program and working out the cameras for that, then went on to, and we went, whoa, stop, back up. And wow. Lee was actually on the team that did the Apollo cameras, especially like the ones on their chest, you know, that were taking the photos of them. And yeah, Hasselblatts and all that. So that book that you're talking about, the
Full Moon, yeah,
has the stuff that his team worked on, and we're desperately trying. He said he would, but he's a busy man.
Yep,
and he's kind of in retirement, has no reason to do it.
He would be in an entire episode.
An entire episode of We're Not Worthy with Lee. So we're just working on that because we are geeks.
That would be a good show, We're Not Worthy. I like that one.
Yeah, really. And honestly, I have, with his permission, I taped my conversation just over coffee because I said, do you mind if I just record this? Because I've got a friend back in Sydney who's going to kill me if I don't. And you've heard it.
It is sensational. If we can capture half of that in
except for it's, we're so fawning, like myself and Zap are just points. Can you just hear us like
doing exactly
just like completely it's our idea of being starstruck.
If only you could recreate that, the gold moment when he says, oh, I did this, and then the Apollo 11 thing, and da-da-da, and you go, whoa, backing that up. Okay, forget Canon 5Ds.
Yeah, we don't give a shit about those sensors. Can we talk to you about the NASA program? And it's And anyway, one of the reasons I mention this is the producer of this program, Todd, who we just eternally am grateful to. Todd is similarly a NASA freak. And it was brilliant that Todd was there with us because he started asking these incredibly in-depth questions about the NASA missions that only a hardcore geek could do. So from you, Matt, where you are in California, to Jason here in Sydney, to myself, to the producers of the program, I don't think you'd find a film beyond Apollo 13 that would appeal to us more. So I'm afraid we're severely lacking in criticism of this film. It was absolutely the film.
I do have one. I want to criticize the single worst effect in the entire film, though. Ed Harris's rug.
You're kidding.
His hair. His hairpiece they made him wear. That's terrible.
I mean, seriously.
That's the thing. I think that's what's great about it is that you can then still entirely today, the effects do not take you out of the picture. Do not take me out of the picture at all. I can entirely watch it from go to O and love it as a film and a story and being completely engaged.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a film. It's not a documentary. But, you know, I would actually say in your list to books and stuff, do watch From the Earth to the Moon, the miniseries from HBO.
Yeah, that is an awesome...
And in particular, there's one whole episode on making the limb.
Lem.
And what did I say?
Yeah, limb. Lem.
Lemon?
Lunar excursion module.
Yeah. Thank you.
The design of that and working out how people would stand.
Doing that,
and
that one episode, I think, is one of my favourite of the entire series.
It's
and
a
I've
great
watched
series.
That, I go, 15
it's
times.
The Band of Brothers of... space race
of space yes
it is yeah it's awesome
yeah
and it's awesome. So nice to see that story told from so many different angles over so much time. Okay, we gotta go. Thank you so much. Now Matt, where can people find you if they want to hunt you down and stalk you?
People can always find me at Virginia Commonwealth University. I'm teaching in the School of the Arts this year in Richmond, Virginia, and you can find me on mattwallen.com or on Twitter at mattwallen.
What are you teaching?
I teach computer graphics.
But you teach more than just the subject of computer graphics. You have special
I'm doing a 3D course. It's an introductory 3D course this semester. And I'm doing a photography / digital cinematography class, which has been super fun. And I do a game class in real-time rendering, which is pretty fun.
Like a GPU thing?
Where we're working on designing and building stuff that goes into an engine that kind of you can navigate in real time and move around.
Cool.
Excellent. And you're on Twitter, et cetera, et cetera?
I think he said he was on Twitter.
Oh, did you say that?
Yeah, all that stuff. All the good Twitters and the whatevers. The inner tubes.
Mr. Jason Wingrove.
Yes. JasonWingrove.com is my main website. Also Vimeo page, Vimeo.com/Wingrove. Twitter.com/Wingrove, and also on the aforementioned Red Center podcast with the person beside me, Mike, at fxguide.com/Red Center, CENTRE.
Can we do a shout out to Todd Chilton, who's, as I said, our producer, and also our other producer, Matt Graham, because the guys do a huge amount of work behind the scenes each week. We try and thank them each week. Sometimes we miss it, but that's only because we're bad people.
Yes, a lot of prep organizing people across five different time zones to get together.
Yeah, seriously. And everybody does this show just out of the generosity of their heart. And we really want to thank you guys for listening as well, because it's been phenomenal, the success the show has had and it's built up. And we get a lot of requests for different shows. I think this one came actually from you, Jason, but normally the retro shows come from suggestions that people make. So if you want to send us some suggestions, do that. Obviously, there's a special page at fxguide.com dedicated to the VFX show. We used to have our own separate website, but it's back integrated over at FX Guide now, but you can still find that. So if you just go over to FX Guide and send us any tips and suggestions you have. We appreciate it. Obviously, some weeks are more controversial than others, but we know these retro shows are super, super popular. So thank you again for downloading it and listening to us. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you guys.